Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Colavita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, welcome to Food Talk. Mike Colomeco here. Heritage Radio Network is what you're listening to live out of the epicenter of hipsterdom right here. That's right, Bushwick, Brooklyn. Beards and beanies, far as the eye can see. That's what we got going on. And tattoos, but most of those are covered with flannel and bespoke knit sweaters at the moment. But they'll come out soon. Anyway, great to be here. Fun show. Got a couple of guests. My first guest in a couple of minutes is going to be Catherine Paul, who is with the Organic Consumers Association. We're going to talk about the new food labeling laws, the improvements that have been made on them, and a rather odd omission having to do with genetically modified ingredients. Well, we'll leave that conversation for a couple of minutes. Recap from last week. Went to see Bill Frisell at the Vanguard, one of my favorite guitarists on the planet, in my favorite jazz club. Great, got there a couple of minutes late after dinner, asked for my usual seat, which is the last seat all the way at the bar in the back corner of the room by the wall. Great seat, maybe the best seat in the house. But somebody was in it, so I sat next to her and made some small talk. It turns out it was Bill Frisell's wife. How cool is that? She was great. Her husband's an amazing guitarist, one of my heroes. We all just talked about music the whole night. Got some snow in Cape May over the weekend. That's right, winter's not over yet. Fucking A. It's March, whatever it was, and we got 8 inches of snow on Monday night. It was ridiculous. I'm so over this winter, but we all are. And then to make matters worse this week, I had Allman Brothers tickets for last night up in the balcony, and I was on the guest list for Friday night's show. A buddy of mine's going to sit in playing sax with them, so you get to hang out with the band backstage. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that. Greg and Warren and Derek and all those boys. Two nights of the Allman Brothers in 1 week. I got a phone call Monday night as the snow was falling. Whole week was canceled. Fuck, Greg Allman's got bronchitis the whole fucking week, so they can't, like, the Allman Brothers, and this was probably their last stint at the Beacon, so I don't know if they're going to, what they're going to do. Hopefully they reschedule that and I get back in. Hey, whatever. It is what it is. Greg's not getting any younger, and he's on his second liver in his 15th marriage, so give the man a break. Looking forward to having dinner tomorrow night at a restaurant that's so under the radar, it's crazy. A place called Le Mangeoir. It's on, I guess, Salt Midtown East, 51st, 52nd, and 2nd Avenue. But I'm going there because the chef is Christian Delouvrier, one of the great, great French chefs in the city. You may remember he got 4 stars at L'Espinasse not that long ago. That was one of the great restaurants ever in New York. I worked with Christian years ago as a sous chef at the Maurice back in the 80s. And I'm going to be going with Shane McBride, who we had on the show a few weeks ago. Shane is Keith McNally's executive chef for all of his restaurants, Balthazar London, Balthazar New York, all of them. And Shane worked for Christian when he was at L'Espinasse, so that's going to be a fun hang. We should have a shit ton of good food tomorrow night at Le Mangeoir. I'll talk about that meal after the fact. This Sunday show, speaking of French food, this Sunday we've got a show coming up on PBS if you watch us in the New York metro area. Two great French restaurants. You know, it's funny. As we came into this millennium, the 2000s, Italian food was so on the rise in this city, it was crazy. And all the great French places had closed, one after another, really. Le Cote Basque, Le Caravelle, Lutèce, gone, all of them. And everyone was kind of reading the obituary for French food, which is nonsense because it's such a great cuisine. And it's really making a comeback. So I skipped AC's Lafayette. I don't know why. AC gets enough press in this world, you know? I mean, AC is amazing. Damien's great. But I was never that stoked about that restaurant. It just seemed like they're playing too conservatively. Right around the corner from it's a place called Les Philosophes on Bond Street that's old school French and is great. And Calliope, I used to love, but now I hear the two chefs, husband and wife, are gone now. Anyway, that's what's coming up on PBS this coming Sunday. If you live in the metro area, you can grab it. Let me go to my first guest because we have to do things in a timely fashion here. She's been waiting on hold. Catherine, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to do the show. So let's talk a bit about these new labeling laws. When were labeling laws redone or modified last time? How many years has it been?
It's been 20 years since the FDA formally updated their rules for the nutrition labels on food, and they say they've been working on this new version for the past 10 years.
It's a big deal. I remember being in the industry as an import agent selling to importers, and I remember when they first came out with the nutritional panel, and it was a big heavy lift for the industry because, you know, you have supermarkets with 40 to 50,000 SKUs. You had some importers that in their books had 15, 16,000 products they were selling, and everybody had to go back to the manufacturer and say, hey, we need this thing done. So it's not easy to do that sort of stuff, and it's a great bit of information. I was always for it because it gives people a window as to what they're eating. So this is the latest thing, but you and I are going to talk about, is there anything that you like about the new labeling laws, the new nutritional panel, in terms of portion size or anything?
Well, sure. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the changes that they've made. It's the serving sizes. You know, food companies have been getting away with advertising these serving sizes as normal when they're not. They're way less than people eat, and then the calorie count that accompanies that serving size looks small. So now we're going to have more realistic serving sizes and more realistic calorie counts, and we're going to put it in larger type. There's nothing wrong with that.
But there's something that's been omitted. Let's talk about it. Why was there no mention of genetically modified ingredients?
Because the U.S. government just absolutely refuses to address this issue, and it's astounding, really, that the FDA would come out with this big announcement about new labels and just completely gloss over the fact that the only label consumers are demanding right now is one that says whether or not their food has been genetically modified.
And genetically modified, just to give a little background on it, it's so widespread. We can almost assume that most of what's manufactured with corn is genetically modified, correct?
Correct.
And corn is in probably a quarter of the things in the supermarket.
At least. I don't know the exact number, but at least it is. High fructose corn syrup is in everything.
Yep.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's like the number one ingredient it's in things you never thought it would be in. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I voted for him twice, but if I'm not mistaken, didn't Barack Obama, wasn't he on record at some point, and I hate to do this to politicians because maybe he said something as a young man that he couldn't keep as president, but hadn't he been on record recently talking about GMOs and wanting to kind of shine a light on that?
He was. It was during the campaign. It was 2007 when he was still a senator campaigning for president. He was in Iowa. But we have a video of him. You can find it on our website. You can find it on the website of Food Democracy Now. We have a video of him saying that, you know, we'll let folks know if their food has been genetically modified because Americans should know what they're buying. That's a direct quote. That's what he said.
Yeah. Yeah, but getting that done is a whole other story because there's a shit ton of money behind the lobbies, and that's a real sore subject with manufacturers, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, the money spent lobbying against labeling GMOs is just mind-boggling, as is the money spent to defeat citizen initiatives in California and Washington State, where we tried to pass these laws. It was over $70 million that the food companies and the biotech companies spent to defeat those laws. They're desperate not to have those labels on food.
Do you want to talk a bit about it, or do you feel you know enough about it? One of the places, and it was also on the ballot there, and I'm not sure, on a small scale, but one of the real testing grounds for GMOs is shocking to me, but it's Hawaii. And it's Hawaii for a reason, because the weather's pretty much pitch perfect all year long. You get to have a ton of crops to play with because the weather is so perfect all year long. And somehow those big three seed companies got their hooks in every island, not just Kauai or Maui, everywhere in Hawaii, bought up parcels of land, rented land that might have been sugarcane, and that's a place now where probably more than anywhere else those seeds are being experimented on. Are you aware of that?
Yes, I'm not as up to speed on Hawaii as some of the other states, but clearly it has been a huge testing ground for GMOs, and the contamination is widespread, the experimentation is widespread, and it's really appalling to think that companies could come in and just test these things and risk that kind of contamination without any safety checks for people.
Yeah, there's been a bit of a rollback and pushback there, but one of the concerns I know, especially on Kauai, was a lot of these lands were abutting public lands, public schools, and it's not just the use of GMOs, but it's specifically the use of GMOs and the pesticides that they're tied with.
Exactly. I mean, these crops can't be grown without tons and tons of pesticides, dangerous pesticides. The key one being glyphosate, which is the key active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup. And the studies that are coming out, you know, almost every week now there's a new study telling us how this glyphosate chemical is far more dangerous than we thought it was, far more of a hazard to our health, especially to the health of children. And yet, we can't, you know, they're linking it to a wide range of illnesses, chronic illnesses, autism, allergies, cancer, infertility, kidney, liver disease. But there's no way to actually trace these conditions to these foods because they're not labeled. And therefore, there's no accountability on the part of the companies that are just spraying these everywhere.
What's the stand in the EU with GMOs right now?
They've been far better than we are.
Yeah.
You can't buy anything in the EU that has GMOs that doesn't have a label on it, and the consequence of that is that there are far fewer GMO foods there because food manufacturers knew that if they put that label on there, consumers wouldn't buy the products. And in fact, every company over here that's putting GMOs in our food, General Mills, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, they have reformulated those products for Europe to be GMO-free.
Yeah.
But they won't do it here in the U.S.
Yeah, because they don't have to. If I'm a consumer, what is a store like Whole Foods? What's their policy? I mean, they're like the big success story in the industry in terms of profitability, in terms of growth, in terms of consumer popularity. What's Whole Foods' stance on GMOs?
Well, they've had to respond to consumer demand. Oh, they were under a lot of pressure during the California Citizen Initiative campaign, which is really when this issue became kind of more mainstream for consumers. The awareness grew. And we couldn't get them to financially support that campaign, but after the campaign was over, they came out and said they're going to label everything in their stores that contains GMOs. I believe by 20, I could be wrong if it's 2015 or 2018, but they've promised to label things, they've promised to get them out of their own store brand, their 365 brand. It's going to take time. It's good. It's a first step. It's a smart marketing move for them.
Yeah, if they follow up on it, that's the big question. Because at the end of the day, too, it's about profitability. And, you know, there are 365 brands sort of built on the idea of healthy slash not expensive, because a lot of the pure organic stuff really can be prohibitively expensive for most people. And I know where they've cut corners on other things, specifically in their poultry and beef supply, working with Tyson. So we'll see what they do with that, I guess.
Yeah.
An interesting call. All right, so if people want information on this, can they go to a website? Let's give a little shout-out to what you do, Organic Consumers Association. Where do you want people to go to find out about you and about GMOs and get active?
You can go to our website, organicconsumers.org. We've been around for 15, 16 years, and while the GMO issue has been sort of not on consumers' minds until the past couple of years, our organization has been fighting it from the day that the FDA approved them with no safety testing and no labels. So we have a lot of information, and we have a weekly newsletter we put out that keeps people up to speed on what's going on with that issue and, of course, many others.
Great. Thanks for coming on. My guest has been Catherine Paul of the Organic Consumers Association. You can visit the website at organicconsumers.org. And don't get me started on U.S. laws in terms of food labeling, because they are some of the worst on the planet. For a country as rich and smart as we are, it's astonishing what the food companies get away with in terms of food labeling. It's the worst. We could do a whole show on that. Thanks for coming on again. Thanks again.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, man. Okay. Again, that was Catherine Paul. Really nice of her to take the time out for the day. We've got two guests that came in to Brooklyn from Manhattan today, two chefs who have really built a beautiful niche for themselves in the West Village, my old stomping grounds. Their initial coming out party was Joey Campanaro at Little Owl back in the day, and I want to talk about that restaurant and kind of why it was so important at that time for, I almost think it was the beginning of kind of a movement, but I'll save that for my first question to them. And Mike Price, who joined the team when they opened up Market Table, as I remember, which was their second restaurant. Now they've got three with the addition of the Clam. All right, gentlemen, you have to get close to your microphones now. Sorry about that. Just squeeze them. You don't need headphones. I'm sorry. I need headphones because she was on my last one was on the phone. So, guys, welcome. Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Joey. Hey, man. So, you know, Little Owl when it opened, what year was it?
Little Al opened in 2006.
You know, I could be wrong, but I've been in the city for a while, and I cover the business. And Frank Bruni was the critic, and it was a funny time. There was the economy wasn't – it was sort of the post-dot-com hangover where the economy wasn't great, and chefs were looking like, what's the new thing? And I think what you captured at that restaurant, and it was kind of the beginning of this, was chefs who – had worked at great places. You had been at the Harrison. You'd worked at starred places. You'd worked at places where they were bigger, more. You took a spot that was tiny and said, you know what? I'm going to do real simple kind of chef-driven food that's great. We're going to do a pork chop. It'll be a great piece of pork. We'll have a special brine for it. We're going to do a burger, but it's going to be a special grind burger. I'm going to make the buns in-house. And you sort of were at the forefront of this idea of small, casual, chef-driven, not terribly expensive restaurants that now they're all over the place. But I think you were kind of at the beginning of that.
It feels like that.
I mean, that's if I had to throw – easy with a long answer. If I had to throw a stone in the water, I mean, I really think you were kind of the guy that said, hey, I'm a chef. I'm in the kitchen. The kitchen's tiny. I remember seeing that kitchen. It was like a joke. I mean, that's smaller than most New York kitchens, apartment kitchens.
What's great about our business in general is that we get to learn from other people in our business, and we share ideas and we share experiences, and we feed off of each other. No pun intended. The fact that you know Mikey and I both, our careers basically started in New York City in 1993, 1994, when we worked with Neil Murphy up at Symphony Cafe in a Midtown restaurant for the Glazer Group at the time. And
so you guys have known each other since then?
Yeah, 20 years.
Wow, that's funny. Okay, I didn't know that.
Right, so Mikey was going to school, and I had just moved to New York. And
from Philly?
I moved to New York from Philly, yes.
Yeah, you know the part of the whole Philly team.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of us.
Yep. I think that we all came out of a Crispo kitchen at some point.
Yeah, well, Frankie's an old friend of mine, man. Frankie and I are the same age, came up around right about the same time. I came here in 82. I think Frankie might have been a year or two before me, but anyway.
And so, you know, as far as the movement goes, you know, it's really important to have a foundation and knowing how to cook and knowing how to teach people how to cook. That's one of the most important things is the nurturing of that. And Mikey and I were fortunate enough to have that experience all throughout our careers. And, you know, I would say it started with Frankie Crispo via DeLulo in Philadelphia.
In Philly, which was right? A big deal. I mean, Frank, that was like the great Italian restaurant right on Broad Street, right?
Yeah, that was
on Broad.
Yeah, across from Academy Music.
Yeah.
And then, you know, ironically enough, Frank Crispo and Neil Murphy worked together at Le Côte Basque, right?
Yeah, which is under the great, great Jacques Rachou.
Right, so Mikey's career and my career are very similar. They're basically parallel worlds. And we've always said that we were gonna do something together at some point. And it turned out that what we ended up doing was opening a very special place called the Harrison down in Tribeca.
And with another Philly expat, Jimmy Bradley.
And yep. And we had left. We had left New York and came back to do that. And it was a really special opening team. And, so we got to work very closely with Jimmy Bradley, and then our careers continued to grow similarly since the first time we've met.
And the Harrison was interesting, you know, just in the context of 9/11, because that restaurant...
That sucked.
It totally. So for those of you that weren't in New York then, well, God bless you, you weren't. Not to mention the people we lost. I mean, I worked at Windows, so... I there were people there that had been there all their whole lives. It was one of those kind of restaurants. So I spent almost a year as the chef at Cellar in the Sky. Anyway, you were the first restaurant. The Harrison was the first restaurant down there to open after 9/11.
That is correct.
And it was. I mean, if you remember what it was like to get down there, you needed three sets of ID. I mean, to get south of Canal Street, you were getting stopped on every corner.
It was also hard to get people to come and work with us. And so when the mayor got on New York One and it ran like 30 times in one day, and he said, "Hey, everybody, go to Lower Manhattan. There's a restaurant called the Harrison." New York really pulled together, and they listened to their mayor, and they went. And needless to say, me, Jimmy, and Mikey were in the weeds every day. Right? So we could talk about, you know, a 28-seat restaurant like Little Al that turns three times, and that's like a piece of cake, you know? The Clam that Mikey just opened up, that's a 40-seater that turns three times, and, you know, it's a little bit harder. Harrison was an 85, 90-seat restaurant with a cafe that was, you know, constantly over 250, 300 covers, and there was no time off. There was nothing. We worked through it. And then, you know, when I say that our careers blossomed very similarly, where, you know, Mikey went on to open the Mermaid Inn with Jimmy, and then we got together to get Market Table along. But, you know, the decision to make a tiny restaurant wasn't based on a trend, or it wasn't thought out that way.
Right. It wasn't like you had this Wharton School business plan, find a cute corner in the village, Grove and Bedford would be ideal.
Yeah, there was no,
this was just a space became available, you heard about it.
Well, my wife told me, she said, "Hey, there's a place on the corner, why don't you get it?" And I was going through a bit of a depression because the restaurant that I was working at was closed, and it was a place called Pache, and it was a huge restaurant, it's 250-seater. And so I went the opposite direction, you know, I was just like, okay, I'll call them. And she's like, "No, call them, like now." And I was like, "I don't feel like calling them." And she's like, "Call it right now." I was like, "Fine, I'll call them." So I called them, and then we got a set up for a walkthrough the next day. And then it was, you know, and it was open in 5 months. It was like a really low budget opening. It, you know, we didn't put there wasn't a huge business plan put together. It was just.
And it had been a little restaurant, a little French place or something, as
I
remember.
There was a restaurant there for over 30 years. There were two restaurants there in that location that I know of. The first one was called Chez K, and the second one was called Chez Michelet.
It's corner of Bedford and Grove, beautiful glass exposure to both streets, but tiny. What do you see, even including the bar? What's the seating at Little Owl?
It's 28 seats.
Including the bar, because
yeah.
The bar seats three. Yeah, it's tiny. Wine storage is in the dining room.
Well, we actually made the bar seat five for you. We created, you know, we label the seats at the bar by, you know, one's called 21, 22, 23, 24. So there's actually a seat 20 right now, and that's dedicated to Mr. Colomeco.
It's the end of the bar. No one's supposed to sit there. You're in the way, pal. But I think I was hungry one night, and
I made you sardines, cavatelli, and a pork chop.
Yeah,
I remember exactly what I cooked for you.
There you go, brother.
And you were standing 4 feet away from me.
And talk about the kitchen there. How big is the kitchen? I mean, that is, even by New York apartment standards, that's one tiny ass kitchen.
The space is 500 square feet, and 350 is dedicated to the dining room.
Right. So the kitchen, you've got a six-burner stove, a small fryolator, and a salamander, and one oven.
And a two-foot grill in an oven, yeah.
Two-foot, that's right. I mean, it's nuts.
We go through those Hamilton Beach griddles probably about eight a year or something like that.
Yeah.
Thank God for the Kmart up there to pick up.
Oh, yeah.
And so Bruni was the critic at the time. And it was funny because you couldn't quite tell. I mean, I had Frank Bruni a few times on the radio. He was a critic for a while. And, you know, I was doing that food talk show at WOR. And I used to get the Times to talk to me whenever I could. And, you know, critics are critics. I mean, nobody agrees with critics all the time. We're chefs, right? So, I mean, you read Sifton, you read Wells. I almost miss Bruni now because you never freaking know what the hell these guys are going to think. But that's their job, whatever. But I remember kind of taking Frank to task because it was almost like he was discouraging ambitious places for some reason. But you ended up on the good side of that because he really was a champion of what you were doing down there. And it wasn't that you weren't ambitious. It was just that there was a simplicity to the food. There wasn't a lot of fuss to it. It was sort of like old-fashioned grandma cooking if your grandma was a badass cook and had the technique that you have.
Yeah.
It was a 2-star review, right?
Yeah, it was a 2-star review.
But a great 2-star review.
Yes, it was. There were some great things that he wrote, and some that I remember are, you know, this is a restaurant that has its limitations. And it couldn't be any more, there couldn't be any more of a true statement. Right. You know, necessity really comes the mother of invention in a space like that. Accepting that as a, you know, accepting the fact and turning that into something that can be positive and that you could teach, then things can really happen. Like, you know, eat it with your hands because we don't have a knife and fork, right? That's kind of cool. You know, broil it.
Steaks.
Broil it because three out of the, well, I'm talking about meatballs, put them on a sandwich.
Right.
Broil it instead of pan sear it because
6 burners.
There's only 6 burners and only 3 of them work. So, you know,
so,
and he got it.
And in New York, that's true. I mean, I don't think people realize, you and I have grown up in kitchens, that it, with every restaurant, the kitchen kind of defines what you're going to do. Some kitchens are great. Most of the time in New York, kitchens suck because it's, if you're spending real estate on a space, you want as many seats as you can, a decent bar because that generates revenue, and the kitchen's almost an afterthought. And so, I mean, you walk into a restaurant like that, you look at that kitchen, and immediately you're thinking, okay, this is the pinch in the hourglass. This is the place where everything is going to move the slowest. How can I get around that? So, yeah, you design the menu around it.
Exactly.
And you still have, to this day, there's enough opinions out there and people that have made a whole career, it seems, talking about hamburgers, which is astonishing. But then again, this is New York. But I say that yours is, that's my favorite burger in the city.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. You know, how that came down was talking with Pat and Mark about a dream blend. And what is it? And in finding out what my disdain was, it's like, well, okay, let's not start what I like about a burger. Let's think what I hate about ground beef. And it's 80-20, like that mystery 20 and mystery, what's 80, what's 20? It doesn't make any sense to me. And so what that is that's exterior fat that gets ground with lean meat. And exterior fat is just it's a protective layer of an animal. It doesn't really do anything except protect. And when it melts as grease. Now, the other types of fat that are in animals are the marbled fat, which you'll find in brisket and short rib and also in the prime cuts most of the prime cuts are prized for that. And the prime cuts are expensive, so you don't want to grind that up. So let's think about this. What makes sense? Let's take a cut of meat that is beautifully marbled that doesn't have the high price tag. Short rib, brisket. Let's grind them individually. Let's grind them together. Let's form them into patties. And that's what it came down to. So, you know, that's a Mark Pastor and Pat LaFreda came up with talking to chefs about, you know, what's yours, and it was brilliant. And
they built a business.
When you get that burger, when you get that patty, and then it's up to you of how you handle it, and that's where technique comes in.
Yeah, the LaFredas were pivotal, and I have to give really almost throw credit back to the dad, Pat Senior. He was, for some reason, he had those grinders in-house on Washington Street forever. Everyone else was buying tubed meat. Everyone else was selling ground meat, for the most part, grinding scraps, but buying tube. And he's been grinding meat forever. So he was like an old-school guy. And right when burgers began to take off, so you were there, Danny Meyer went to see him. Everybody went to see him and said, so what can you do for us that's custom?
Yeah.
And Mark Pastore, he's just like his dad. He works from fucking 11 o'clock at night till 8 in the morning. He doesn't play. And so he would bring chefs in late at night and just play with grinds. And they went from, you know, 15, 20 million a year gross business to double that in 5 years due to ground meat and Creekstone and now all the other shit that they have. But it all grew out of the hamburger thing. But the bun on your burger, I'm talking about analysis, because a burger, so the meat's amazing. But talk about that bun, because that's a killer too. I mean, this is a little restaurant that has no room, and you're baking your own buns.
It's a pizza dough recipe.
You told me. Yeah. And it has a little bit of, is it molasses or honey in it?
Well, instead of using sugar, we use molasses to activate the yeast. And I find that something other than sugar, which activates the yeast, causes a more of a steady rise. So you'll end up with a little bit of a denser bun where you have the small air pockets in it. And for a burger that's as juicy as that patty, you need something to collect it.
Yeah, you described it to me one day, and it was perfect, because it's not ginormous. It's 8 or 9 bites. But the argument with, I mean, the wrestling match with eating a burger is the first bite's always going to be great, the next couple of bites are great, and then pretty soon halfway through, I mean, if you have one of those potato rolls, it's just like two wet napkins with something in the middle, and it's dripping all over your hand and your feet, and you're that density, the grain in your roll, it's way tighter than a ciabatta. I mean, it's like the perfect burger bun.
And it also, we use that for the meatball sliders too. But what happens with the meatball sliders is during the...
That's right. You had 3 of those that come out. Now, right. When I'm sober, I'm okay. It takes me a while to remember these meals, you see.
And so what happens with those is, you know, during the kneading process and the portioning process of the dough, we'll fold in roasted garlic and then top it with pecorino cheese. And so now that's a customized bun for the meatball, and then the burger bun gets his own thing. And then what Mikey does with his buns is he seasons them with butter and Old Bay for
just one.
We had a crab cake sandwich that he make. Mikey's a Maryland, you know,
Maryland
crab
guy.
Cake
he told you. I remember. Reppin'. I think we filmed you when you were at the Mermaid. I think.
Yep.
That's yeah. Right. Because what's-his-name couldn't make it because he was too hungover. You'd just gotten reviewed the night before.
I think we make lobster rolls?
You made lobster rolls, and Jimmy was supposed to come, and I got a call through his PR people. The night before, I think the Red Hat got a review that was great, another 2-star review that was just so positive, and he was so wasted and so hungover that he couldn't even make it. I'm like, don't worry, dude. I'll get to you
later. I don't
believe
that for a second.
He's... Well, that's what he told me. All right, we got to take a quick break. This radio show is supported by numerous ways. People make donations, which is great. You can do that at heritageradionetwork.org. And we have a couple of funders that help make my show specifically happen, so we're going to give them a minute, and I'll be back in 3 or 4 with more conversation with Joey Campanaro and Mikey Price of the Little Owl, Market Table, and the Clam.
Today's music is by Brothers NYC on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Any good chef will be honest with you and tell you about 80% of good results from cooking is good shopping. You have to start with great ingredients. So when I'm looking to make a canned tomato sauce at home, I use Cento San Marzano tomatoes, which I've loved, used them for years. When I had my restaurant, that's what I bought. When I was a chef at restaurants and I could supervise the purchasing, that's what I ordered. They're great. I actually had a chance a few years back to go visit the area where they're from because I'm always curious with ingredients. what is the provenance? So we flew in the middle of August to this little region just in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, where there's great volcanic soil. And what I found out was these tomatoes come from lots of small family farms, little quarter and half acre plots, where that's what they do. They raise tomatoes and sell it to the Cento factory that packs this tomato in the peak of the season in the middle of the summer. Cento nourishes the San Marzano tomatoes from start to finish with a 100% certified traceability program. Cento's San Marzano certification is the only one of its kind, assuring the consumer of authentic San Marzano tomatoes. So if you're looking for great canned tomatoes for great tomato sauce, look no further than Cento brand San Marzano. Michael Ameco here. When I started my PBS show, one of the deals with producing a PBS show is you're always looking for underwriters, and I thought, let me start first by going after people whose products I actually use in my kitchen. I had a restaurant for years. I used Colavita olive oil. I did some research and found out that in the extra virgin category, it was the only Italian olive oil that was actually 100% Italian origin. There's a lot of stuff going on in that business that we don't really want to talk about, but a lot of the big brands call themselves Italian, have Italian flags on the labels, and their blends from tank farms from all over the planet. Pretty much based on price. Colavita is the exception. Really love the oil. Been using it in my house. Reused it in my restaurant. Well, Colavita is doing something neat. They're doing a contest. If you go to italycontest.com or colavita.com, where there's a link, but again, Italy Contest is the more direct way to do it. They're doing a contest on substituting butter for olive oil in baking goods. The winning recipe gets a free trip to Italy, courtesy of Colavita. So if you're thinking about cooking with olive oil and you're a baker, throw them your recipe at italycontest.com or visit colavita.com and click the link there. You may win a trip to Italy.
King Arthur Flour, established in 1790, is America's oldest flour company. They're an employee-owned company whose passion is sharing the joy of baking and inspiring bakers worldwide. When King Arthur was founded in 1790, George Washington was the newly elected president of the United States. The company was sold by the Sands family to King Arthur Flour employees in 1996. They are now an ESOP company, 100% employee-owned, with a 100% commitment to quality. Visit them at kingarthurflour.com.
Got chefs talking in here. I don't have my headphones on. I don't know. Anyway, we're back. We're back live. My two guests are the owners of three restaurants. Chef Mike Price and Joey Campanero have, between them, the Little Owl, the Market Table, and the newest, the Clam, all almost a stone's throw from each other in one of my favorite neighborhoods where I lived for 10 years. But had to leave because when time came to buy, I couldn't afford it. It's charming. It's tree-lined. It's cobblestoned. It's expensive. It may be the most expensive. Oh, they say Tribeca, but I'll tell you what. The West Village is... There's some price numbers over there that are stupid. Mike Price, talk to me about Market Table because you were the opening chef, and that was your baby. So talk a little bit about that because I remember you were right down the street from the place where I was a frequent flyer, Rick Kelly's guitar store on Carmine Street.
Yeah, one of the great guitar stores in New York.
Great guitar stores in New York City. He's one of the great luthiers. His specialty is building custom electrics with vintage New York wood. That's his theory. He made a couple limited series of guitars with... Jim Jarmusch hangs out there, the filmmaker. And Jim's
I've seen him walk by a few times.
He's in Kelly's all the time, man. He's got the big-ass gray hair sitting up in those shades. But so Jim, when he redid his loft on the Bowery, Rick got a bunch of wood from the roof of the loft, like 140-year-old old-growth yellow pine. And he made a series of guitars out of those. G.E. Smith has one. I have two. And Jim has a couple. But anyway, to talk about opening, because that, I mean, that was, you were there. I remember.
It was intense.
You were getting, most chefs don't have tans, and I'm a jerk off. I live at the beach in the summer, so come July, and I'm Italian. So come July, man, I'm a Moulinian. You don't even know what the heck, I don't wear sunscreen. I just turn brown and darker brown. And then that tan will stay with me through like October, November, even December, because I'm just wearing board shorts and flip. And I remember going by there as you opened, and you're a white skinned pale guy, and you were just getting paler and paler. And I remember it's like, oh, dude, this guy is. So how many weeks did you work in a row without a day off for that open?
Six.
Yeah.
Eight.
Yeah, it was pushing 2 months.
It was interesting because, you know, we had a market in half of the space, and that market would open at 7 o'clock in the morning. So, I mean, it was a little bit of a reverse psyche there where normally you open a restaurant for dinner first. We actually opened the market and we opened for lunch first, which was something that was, you know, new to both Joe and I as far as the market's concerned. And it was, you know, I feel like educational. We had a good go of it. I think it really embedded us into the neighborhood in a lot of ways, that we were able to create relationships that carried over. But eventually we got to the point where the demand for the seats were just too intense to ignore it. And
just for listeners to understand, you walked in. The restaurant was really kind of two rooms. The entrance room had the kitchen in it in the back. And you had it set up with displaying. You had a refrigerator there, a walk-in, a reach-in, and you were selling stuff. Lettuces, artisanal stuff, eggs, butter. And I just remember I remember thinking as a restaurateur. And then the other dining room was the dining room proper. And I remember just thinking, dude, look where you got Citarella a couple blocks away. You got Faiko's down the street. You got Amy's Bread. You got Murray's Cheese. I mean, what are you selling shit for? I can buy everything you have without coming here, make money on tables. And sure enough, 4 or 5 months in, the market end of it turned into more seating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was some fun stuff we were playing around. I feel like some of the prepared stuff was more on that end, where, you know, we would braise lamb shanks, cryovac them, and sell them, and you could take it home, and you had your own kind of braised lamb shank dinner, which was pretty special. But at the end of the day, it's about dollars and cents in a lot of ways, and it's hard to ignore the fact that you're selling, you know, 10 cups of coffee and watching 40 people walk out the door because you don't have enough seats. Right. I mean, you know, We both love cooking very much, but we also have to pay the bills.
Hey, and same landlord, right? Good guy. Yeah, you which is a nice thing in New York, because if you guys know from being pros, I mean, half of opening a restaurant is just trying to get a lease that works.
Yeah, he was actually
used to be the old Shoptions.
Yeah. Used to be old Shoptions space. Yeah.
Right. He's the Essex Street Market, and I don't go there either. It's not like getting a shoe thrown at you. That
we had an exorcism before we got in there. Cleaned it all out.
when we talked to the landlord about the concept, one of his first questions was, "What's Plan B?" And he's a really smart guy, and, you know, he cares. He wants us to be successful.
And Plan B was pull out the market and turn it into tables, which is what you did.
And
you've been running success ever since. You opened that in 08?
08.
Okay.
You know, we didn't get reviewed from Bruni until about a year and a half into it. I think there was that kind of ambiguity as far as the market and how this place was actually going to shake down. And he ended up coming in and really, really loving it and writing us a love letter, a 2-star review. And it was super exciting after putting in that much work and effort to get to that point to kind of get the reward at the end.
Yeah, opens are brutal. If people have never opened, I mean, openings are just like, it's like having a kid or something. I mean, closest guys are ever going to get. I mean,
I'm in the middle of it right now. I'm on, what is it, 3 months? Two and a half months?
Right. You know, what we learned from, you know, the evolution of that business, Michael, was to continually edit yourself, you know, and say, okay, this is an idea. Let's really think through it. Right. And we were lucky enough that we didn't lose it. You know, it was, we got a second chance.
Yeah, and it's a great neighborhood. It's funny. There's a lot. I mean, around the corner from you is one of my other favorite little places. I think Jody Williams at Bouvette she really hit the ball over the fence this time. I've known her for many, many years when she was at Mirandi and all those little wine bars where she was kind of struggling along to make do and you couldn't quite tell what you were signing up for. And the first couple times I went to Bouvette, I was like, you're kidding. She figured it out. But my point is, the broader point is that that's right around the corner from you almost, on the other side of 7th. But the neighborhood just sustains. If you're good and you're fairly priced, and the food's solid, and you've got good service, the West Village is, they'll come.
It's a really great supporting neighborhood.
We support the neighborhood as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a little give and a little take. Where, you know, when the public school comes knocking, we're into it. If you want some food because your mother's sick, you need something to go, we're doing it. You know, there's a lot of that. Where, I think, you know, apart from the size of the spaces and the simple food, I feel like what Joe did at the Little Owl and what we've been able to kind of transfer to Market Table and then to the Clam is a lot of ways taken out that pretentiousness and really making them unpretentious and really hospitality-driven restaurants. Because, you know, the food's great, the spaces are good, but really at the end of the day, people feel really good about coming there, and that's what it's about.
Yeah, and it's hospitality. I talk about that a lot. It's one of the things I wish that more Brooklyn restaurateurs would attach themselves to. But at the moment, it seems to be a non-issue here because it's a kind of a youthful, kid-run restaurant scene where hospitality doesn't seem to matter as much. And I think that was the zeitgeist that you had at Little Owl was so, you know, small kitchens, the kitchen at Market Table is not that big. You got to build it. It's better. It's not Little Owl size, but it's still going to be a defining point. But so get great ingredients. Let's think of them like chefs. Use the term Edling, which is really important. You know, stuff works, it sells. If it doesn't sell, it doesn't work. Pull it off the menu. And, you know, this isn't about pride and ego, which is another thing I think that sometimes chefs, and disagree with me if you think I'm wrong, but in a way, sometimes chefs are the worst people to open up restaurants because all we think about is the food.
Well, you really have to have an opportunity to connect the dots. Yeah. You know, if you have to answer your phone, you have to work the bar, you have to be a maitre d', you have to be able to connect those dots is super important, Michael. You know, and that's what we do. We have staff meetings twice a year. And about, I'd say about 5 years ago, I made everybody connect the dots. Like, if you want to work here, you have to work in a different area, in a different station. You have to understand someone else's job, not just yours.
Yeah, smart.
And that really, really helped. And it was something that I did myself. I'm not going to do something. I'm not going to tell somebody to do something that I can't do myself.
Yeah, as a guy that owned a restaurant, man, it's fucked up.
Well, you remember Captain Max?
Especially if you're a little guy. We're not talking about like Thomas Keller, who I adore, who they won him in the Time Warner. He's an A. If you're like a regular schmuck like me that opens a restaurant, you're going to become good at fucking plumbing, fixing clogged toilets, cleaning up vomit, fixing the ice machine, crawling up on the compressors of the walk-in box.
Talking people off of ledges.
Don't laugh. I mean, it's the shit that happens in the restaurant business. It's unlike anything else.
Do you remember Captain Max in Wildwood, New Jersey?
I didn't eat there, but it was there.
Yeah, that's
where you got started.
That was my first dishwashing job. Yeah, I was 12.
I remember I had a restaurant in Cape May, and I had a really brilliant chef that came down for me one summer to work for me. He knew Thomas Keller. I remember interviewing him in New York saying, you're too qualified. You don't want to do this. You're too qualified. And for some reason, he did. So he came down. His food was great. He started in May. July 4th weekend, I get a phone call. It's midnight and I'm back at my house, like a Friday night. It's the police. He's on the roof of my restaurant throwing stones at cop cars. I show up. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? I'm not going to mention his name. What the fuck are you doing, dude? So then the other cooks come up to me and they're like, Mike, this guy, he's nuts. Once he starts drinking, he goes, he never drinks on the job. You leave this restaurant at 10:30 at night, he starts fucking drinking. He's a shit. We were going to tell you. Either we're all leaving or he's got to go. You know, the next fucking day, he was on the bus north to New York City, and I was a fucking line cook again.
Right,
God
right.
Damn it. July 4th weekend, Charlie. Thank you very much. So let's talk about the new place. Let's talk about the clam, because that's the new baby. So when you were at Harrison, you had fried clams on the menu. That was like a signature thing, didn't you?
Yes.
So this is tell me about the connection. Why clam, your connection? I mean, chefs love this stuff, but talk to me why.
Mikey and I both agree that chef's favorite ingredients, you know, are – like, if you like an ingredient, you have a crave for that ingredient, you have respect for that ingredient. We determined which ingredient that is, and we both feel that it's clam. The clam, you know, a clam is, it's hardly any fat, it's protein, flavor. You don't have to do anything to it to make it taste good. It's one of the most sustainable organisms on the planet. I mean,
off the Jersey Shore, man. A lot of clams you're eating are coming off the Jersey waters. The LaMonicas, I know the family that, man, they built a fortune off of just that, clamming.
We like it.
And I eat raw clams. I'm a clams on the half shell guy in the summer. I mean, please. So the concept of the restaurant is clams and variation plus seafood? Talk to me.
It's
I haven't been in yet.
It's kind of, you know, the inspiration is clams. There's probably 8 or 10 solid clam dishes on the menu. That's everything from chowder to a clam dip and a sandwich, stuffies, We're doing a spaghetti and clams. You know, all the bases are covered. And then kind of anything I associate with that. You know, there's a New York strip steak on the menu because after I have a bowl of steamed clams, sometimes I want a steak, you know. And sometimes I want to have a duck breast before I have the spaghetti and clams. You know, it's anything that I associate with it. And, you know, people, the response has been undeniably good. I feel like clams have never really had their day. That's just it, I think. I think that's there's a lobster restaurant. There's a crab restaurant. There's in New York, in that seafood realm, right. Clams have never really had their moment, you know.
True.
And it's obvious that people share our passion for clams because people are coming, which is good.
And so give me the address. Hudson and Leroy.
Hudson and Leroy, and it's 420 Hudson Street.
420 Hudson, so we're sort of the south end of the West Village on that kind of west side.
Yeah.
It's like the doorway to Greenwich Village.
It's pushing that southern limit of Hudson Street, but you know, you can walk down from the meatpacking. You walk up from Tribeca.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
You walk across from Greenwich Village. Right. I mean, it's...
Soho's so close.
There's just that whole area is just open. I mean, I believe the most expensive... The big income per capita now, the most wealthy zip code is Tribeca, just to your south. And the West Village has to be very close behind it because, like, I mean, I left because my apartment that I bought would have cost me twice as much money if I stayed in that neighborhood, and there's no way. I mean, I'd rather have space and views than staring at a wall on Bedford Street because I wanted to be on Abingdon Square. It's not going to happen.
We were lucky enough to get another great space.
Good.
I mean, truth be told, Little Owl is a corner spot with big windows. Market Table is a corner spot with big windows.
Yep.
And the Clam is a corner spot with big windows. So to lock up those three leases in that neighborhood with that quality of space, I think we, you know, feel really good about and proud about. You know, it's not hard to make a good deal in New York.
And 40-some seats.
40-some seats.
And you're doing the... you're telling me, like, on weekends, it's hundreds and hundreds of covers. So it's crazy. Do you take reservations or all walk-in?
No, we take reservations.
Good, thank you.
Yep.
Good.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you.
We're going to be opening for lunch and brunch soon, which will be great. We're going to get some outdoor seats soon, which will be great.
Good.
So we're not done growing yet. We're still in that kind of initial growing stage as far as the growth of the business goes.
Just so people know, to Joey's point, because I touch on this a lot, we have people on the show that talk about seafood sustainability. Completely correct about clams. They're sustainable. It's a managed fish species. Some of those big clams, the ones that like go into industrial, the quahogs and the surf clams, 50 to 60 to 70 years old, man.
Yeah.
That's how long they live.
Wow.
And they're harvested by boats that go out and actually kind of vacuum the bottom, blow open the sand beds, then suck them up, drain off the water, soak them. And the La Monica family that is really responsible, if you buy it's Cape May clam or La Monica brands, you see it everywhere. I mean, they kind of cornered. They're Staten Island people via Brooklyn. They now live in South Jersey. They took over the old Snow's Seafood factory, which is kind of near Vineland off of 55. All those clams are shucked by hand.
That's awesome.
It's insane. You think this was automated? No way. It's all done by hand.
There's so much respect for that old school business, and the ingredient in itself, it's like an enigma. It's mysterious.
Clams.
And whenever I'm writing recipes, just saying, and if I say, I always put the caveat: if you can't make your own clam stock, use the Cape May brand. Use the Cape May because it's the, you know, one of the best brands of clam juice out there.
It is, and they've got the market locked, and it's a great. And I've done some homework on that too. So now if Joey, you're still kind of overseeing Little Owl. Mikey, you're the new baby's the new baby, the clam. How do you manage Market Table? How's that working?
Well,
just kind of autopilot. We don't care. Just let it go downhill.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah, whatever.
We'll do all that work just to piss it away.
That's right.
I got to tell you, the staff at Market Table is some of the most competent people I've ever met. The general manager's name's Matt, and he worked with us as a server and came up through the ranks. And he was there while Mikey was the executive chef there. And Mikey and Matt really worked together to make sure that restaurant will sustain basically anything, right? And so Mikey and I also met a guy named David Standridge, and he took over as the executive chef. He stayed on for just under a year while Mikey was still in the kitchen there, and then the handoff happened. And then that's where we are right now with it. And we couldn't be happier with the jobs that the staff are doing there, with the relationship between David and Matt, and the fact that we were able to create an old-school system of Maitre D', which is also implemented at the Clam and at Little Owl. It's like, you know, like Arnold from Mineta. You know, it's a lost position. Where do you find that? You know?
Yeah, it's funny. Arnold, if you don't know, folks, Arnold was a chef for most of his life.
Yeah. From Philly.
From Philly. I don't know how old he is. I'm so old, I don't know how old anybody is anymore. He could be my age. 50s, 60s, whatever. Bald-headed guy, real dapper, real trim, tons of energy. Usually really well-dressed with a vest on.
Look up Maitre D', there's going to be a picture of Arnold.
And the smile.
Yeah. The smile.
Fucking 1,000-watt smile.
Arnold comes in.
And imagine working the door at Mineta, because that's got to be a shit show. Yeah, between the tourists, the models, the jerk-offs, the egos, the people that you're supposed to know. Keith's, I mean, they actually have a meeting there before service where they talk about the AAA, AA, and A-list customers. Like, I didn't know there was a fucking distinction. We have VIPs, VVIPs, and triple VIPs. Oh, okay. Holy mackerel.
He was just in for dinner the other night at the bar, literally 2 nights ago. He's a great guy.
Great guy. The classic.
Walks in with a bottle of Premier Cru champagne just to get the... He's like, you know, there's that kind of class.
Right. Yeah. Well, Keith. Credit to Keith, man. We did a show on Balthazar and Mineta a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, Keith McNally has not had a misstep in New York City, except Bellino's. But, you know, everybody loses one once in a while, but he's going to reopen that as something more in the generic Shishimi. Mean, he's going to be somewhere between Schiller's and Mineta and whatever, and Chino's in the kitchen, so it's going to be a hit. So your new chef, tell me where he worked before you, because it's interesting.
He was, really interesting. This ties into your original conversation about what Little Al is and was and does. David came, he was a sous chef at Atelier de Joel Robuchon.
So that little jewel of a restaurant in the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
And when you think of Robuchon, I mean, really one of the great chefs of France for the 70s and 80s. I mean, Jamin was 3 stars from, I believe it's open till the day he walked away at 50.
Yeah.
Took a year or two off and came up with the Ateliers. First Vegas, then I think New York was second or third. But that was a great little kitchen. And that's really refined food.
Yes. And then, you know, knowing how to create refined food and knowing how to cook both at the same time is... You don't find many people that know how to do that. And then also someone that can actually make a decision on what they want to do in their life next, right? So just like I took a step from a 250-seater to a 28-seater, I feel like David made a conscious decision to say, I'm going to make food from what I made for the last 6 years. The same heart and soul, the same energy that it takes, the same dedication to the quality of the final product, but we're going to make it accessible to everyone through Market Table.
Mm.
And so basically he adopted that restaurant.
And it's a great step for him because now he's an executive chef. Now this is his stepping out party.
He gets to see so many different things right now, because when you take those blinders off, the most important thing is to just never forget, and you'll always be able to grow.
Give me some advice. We got a lot of young cooks that listen to this show, and I always ask chefs, and I won't put you on the spot, but if you had to, in a nutshell, got a young kid coming out of culinary school, thing, what would your advice be to young cooks, either of you guys or both of you guys? Because I think the industry is just over-dramatized. I think people think this is something else till they get in it, and then it turns out that, holy mackerel, it's a shit ton of work, and you know it's not what it looks like on TV.
It certainly isn't. I think some TV shows are getting better at it, but you know the competition part is, you should compete with yourself first and foremost. So, you know, we didn't open restaurants or become chefs because we wanted to be, in quotes, better or beat or do anything to anybody else except make good food and create a nice place where nice people work and live their lives. And I think Mike, you'll agree to me, because this is something that, you know, because our careers were so similar and people that we worked for and the things that we learned, one of the most important things that we learned was how not to be. Mm-hmm. But we also worked for people that allowed us to find our own voice and question ourselves and ask ourselves about dishes that we prepare or rooms that we create or menus that we build. Then we get to ask ourselves, do we love it? And if we don't love it, then we don't do it. If you don't love it, don't do it.
Because you're going to, I mean, again, you guys, you're coming off of working 2 months, 2.5 months without a day off. I mean, we're looking at weeks that are 80, 90 hours, that are endless. If you don't love this business, and if you're not about the food and about being better and about pushing yourself, you pick the wrong career.
And, you know, I can't stress enough the value of working up through the ranks. I mean, you know, you can't walk out of culinary school and expect to be a sous chef.
You're not.
Three or four.
You're barely a line cook. Barely. And probably not.
That's right. So, you know, to have realistic expectations when you're starting out in this career, I feel like is a huge step in the right direction, because you're not starting out with that disappointment, or starting out with somebody being disappointed in you, for that matter. Right. Where you can really kind of work your way up.
Thank you. That was Mike Price, before him Joey Campanero, my two guests today. Visit their restaurants. They're all great. The Little Owl, again, my favorite burger in the city, and just a great hang. Never had a bad meal there. Never sent anybody there that didn't say, damn, that was good. Market Table, same story, ditto. That's the second home run, and I'm sure the Clam is going to be number three. I'll get to your place soon, guys.
Sounds good.
Thanks. Hey, you listen to Mike Colomeco's Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network. We're going to wrap it up. It's been an hour. I'll let you know next week how it went tomorrow night at Mangeoir with Shane McBride, but I'm looking forward to a fantastic meal. We'll see you all next week. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.